This is the Sounding Board Podcast with Hutchie and Damo. Thanks to Drinkwise. If you're choosing to have a drink, choose to drink wise.
Good to have your company on the Sounding Board, episode 6 of series 6 for Drinkwise. If you're choosing to have a drink, choose to drink wise. There's been a massive week of media moments. Meghan and Harry, we'll get to that in a moment with Oprah. Christian Porter's extraordinary media conference, Nathan Buckley breaking his silence, and a couple of very, very senior international journalists pranked by a YouTube setup. Craig Hutchison's in Sydney, Damien Barrett here in Melbourne. G'day, Hutchie.
Or Brighton, more specifically, which is why the echoes of your house are permeating through the podcast, because such is the size of the place that you're renting as part of the make good for your neighbour single-handedly destructing your home with water damage. Good morning to you, Damo. And on a more serious note, the night on Australian television last night was journalism old school. It was two completely different stories of completely different social significance. On the ABC on Four Corners last night at 8:30, we had the Canberra bubble story and Louise Milligan, who's been a big part of it and driving the story, and the situation surrounding Christian Porter. And then you had Oprah with Harry and Meghan. Hard to know where to start. Which caught your attention first of all, and what did you watch mostly?
I watched the Four Corners report. I haven't yet seen the Meghan report, but I feel like I was across that because our mate over in the States, Brad Blanks, was live texting us the developments in that story, Hutchie. Again, I've recorded that part of it, haven't yet seen it, will do so. But as far as a media event goes internationally, that is right up there, I would think.
So there's a couple of things from a journalistic life flick, by the way, between both, and caught up a little bit on them both afterwards. So I watched most of both, but none of all. A couple of terms in the Harry and Meghan, if we could start there for you, Damo. Harry talked about the invisible contract, which on pressing from Oprah, and by the way, it was an old school journalistic get from Oprah. Well done to Oprah. That was journalism at its purest, to get a big subject in a prime time slot that can go around the world. Doesn't get much more journalistic than that. The invisible contract was what Harry talked about as being an unspoken rule between the royal family and Fleet Street, that if the royal family give access, then Fleet Street report favourably. How many invisible contracts, Damo, have you been party of or known about in your journalistic life?
None, to be absolutely upfront. There may be a perception of certain arrangements, Hutchie, but to actually say they exist in a form where every single party knows about them, I don't think so. And I don't think you would have even come across such matters. I wouldn't have thought. Not at the levels of journalism that you and I reached anyway.
Well, invisible contract was a term used by the royal family. We've often talked about these themes. I argue there's almost always one. I think invisible contracts between the media and the subject happen regularly and frequently. They're certainly prevalent in politics. No question we're seeing that at the moment. The notion that the royal family feared the press coverage and spent a lot of time worried about that would have been confronting to some people. Was that the... I know there's a lot more deeper things to explore, but this is kind of our cup of tea, the media side of things. What did you think of that? Can you believe that the royal family were as paranoid about the press coverage as Harry indicated that they would be?
Well, a couple of things to take out of it, Archie. Are you going to believe everything that Meghan and Harry have said? Because I'm not. So I need to say that from the outset here, because just because they've said it and they've said it on camera, I'm not necessarily, as a consumer, going to take everything at 100% face value. To your question about the fear, of course. I mean, the whole. I mean, you can insert a football club in Melbourne. You can insert a rugby league club in Sydney. You can insert a cricket team into this conversation when you talk about a big organisation fearful of media coverage. Yeah, the royal family to me has come across regularly as very fearful of what has been done and could be done.
You talk about being in the tent with the subject and the journalist. Harry said that part of the in-the-tent strategy, my words, not his, was to have the journalists go have their Christmas parties at Buckingham Palace. That would have, if you were watching that, You've seen the way that the royal family is covered. Wouldn't have crossed anyone's mind that the journos are going there for private Christmas parties. I mean, that was a lift the veil moment on how the institution works with the... He inferred that it was a social contract that each relied upon each other. The royal family relied upon the media keeping them relevant, prevalent, and the institution of it being up in lights, and vice versa. And they were in it together. And he found it difficult because he'd fallen foul clearly of the media in the last few years. It was a really interesting take on how journalists and a subject rely upon each other on an extreme level.
Use of the phrase "the firm" as well. What did you make of that? Because to me that was another layer of derogatory comment about the institution.
No question it was. I mean, it was hard to turn off. It was confronting, and I found there were two simultaneous stories last night that were compelling, and you needed to know as much as you could about both. So, rare night in Australian television. Clearly, it was designed to do a little bit of damage. It did damage, without question, today, right? Like the who was it on the racial side of things has become the story of today after Oprah went on her friend Gail King's show this morning in the States and ruled out that it was the Queen or Prince Philip. So everyone now narrowing in on who they think it sort of cast everyone as a suspect, really. And the conflicting emotions you felt during it. So I felt it was insensitive to do the interview at this time, for starters, because you've got England and London who have been through the worst kind of pandemic and COVID, hundreds of thousands of deaths, still many people who are recovering, lockdown, unspeakable public health toll. Their fear, their concerns, or many of their concerns, felt rather insensitive to the plight of the country and what it's been through. On the other hand, I found myself finding a little bit for them both and the spot they got themselves in. You know, I felt empathy and the casual racism suggestion is appalling. Some of the way that they say we're treated, you can't walk past or ignore. And I felt for their struggle as well. You couldn't be insensitive to that either. So it was really hard to kind of marry those two things up. The fact that they were doing a tell-all at the same time as they're denouncing the media intrusion in their lives was really hard to get your head around as well, and yet it was gripping television. So that were the competing thoughts in my head as I watched it.
The other element, Hutchie, and we might move off it in a moment because we're probably getting into that zone where we don't have the depth of knowledge on the full topic. But the referencing the suicidal thoughts, Hutchie, which is a serious concern for obvious reasons. But given that this is the now wife of Harry, whose mother Diana, and you recall the time of her passing back in 1996, I think it was, or 97, one of those 2 years, where she was hounded. You only have to read the stories and live the moment. She was hounded by the media. Now, here we now have another person in the royal family saying that these thoughts are very much apparent in her head. And yet it's almost being dismissed. I mean, I think there needs to be a proper listening and adherence to what she said in that part of that interview.
Yeah, what did Ross Lyon say? You can challenge the behaviour and support the person. And the behaviour of doing the interview you can, and why, and then the time of it you can challenge. But I don't think that means you can't support the public cry of help. It was a public cry of help last night. And I'm sure that they'll get the support they need. You're seeing some of the voices emerge in the States today and supportive of them, and that the American celebritydom will be, for lack of a better term, will rally around, won't they? I mean,
yeah, you know, well, Serena Williams has already.
Yeah, and Oprah was the perfect person to the interview. Empathetic, sympathetic, understanding, a neighbour clearly in Santa Barbara or Montecito. That's where they live and that's where Oprah calls home, and obviously knows everyone who's everyone in the States. So it was more aimed at winning the Americans over than it was denouncing the English. But I couldn't help but feel for her on that front as well, Damo. I really did. And so it was hard to kind of compete. They were all competing emotions for me. Last point. One thing I'm not buying is they weren't paid for the interview. Now, I know that they were asked that question early in the interview, and they said that they weren't. And it was clear that they wanted to be asked that question so that they could clear the air on that. But as we've talked about many times on the sounding board, there are ways to be paid without being paid, and almost always that is the case. An example, are you being paid for this interview? No. Is there a commercial benefit to you or anyone associated to you as a result of doing this interview? Would have been a more appropriate question. Like, it might be something as simple as Oprah's paying the security bills for 12 months or, you know, something like that. But that's where my head went, because if a $7 million went from CBS to Oprah or to Harpo Productions, the networks were on selling the rights around the world and getting $325,000 US, a 30-second slot in the States. There's a money tree going on around this interview. There's not a chance they're not in that cycle somewhere. Now, are they getting a direct check? I'd agree no. But are they being paid or having services offset somewhere? My head went to the security because it was Harry's clear objective to get his family looked after. And I don't think anyone could begrudge if he said, look, my security intel for the next 2 years, Oprah is $1.5 million a year, by two, it's $3 million. That's half of what you're going to make. The invoices are coming to you for 2 years, but you take the upfront check. I'm okay with that. I've got no problem with that. They've got a $100 million Netflix deal that they've done, don't forget, as well. So they are, media is their source of income. They are in the media business. They are media entities.
I'm not buying that. I'm not buying they didn't get a payment of sorts like you out of that interview. Hey, let's move it on. You were all over this. Royal commentators hoaxed into critique of Meghan interview before seeing it.
Yeah, so hubris kicked in. Four commentators agreed on a YouTube clip to review the show they hadn't yet seen, on the proviso that it was embargoed until afterwards, and it dealt with hubris and ego. And that's what happened. So it was a hoax. They came unstuck. Royal commentators.
This is right in our wheelhouse when it comes to presenting media products to the public. So just to back over that, the interview with these four media identities or royal watchers, whatever it is they call themselves, was scheduled in the pitch to these people within an hour of the Meghan interview going to air. These four people with egos you couldn't jump over all said, yes, we will do it, just simply to get their names out there. And what happened clearly was the people who set them up were pitching them questions about topics that were just making up.
Yeah,
and claiming to have been in the Meghan interview, which couldn't have been possible given it at that point had not been aired. So clearly there's a couple of things that question here. Credibility is just out the window for those people, and clearly that's what they base their lives on. And the gullibility of people who, Hutchie, looking at the faces of these people involved here, I didn't know them before you set this thing through last night, but they've clearly been around a long time. They haven't come down in the last shower, at least on an age perspective. So how naive can you be?
Put this in perspective. The editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine, Ingrid Seward, said of the Duchess, to her mind, this was an actress giving one of her great performances. From start to finish, Meghan was acting. That's recorded without her having seen the interview before the interview. Royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliam said it was not a balanced interview, and Oprah gave the couple an easy ride and being totally sympathetic. And he had not seen it. He said Meghan used extremely strong language to describe her relations with members of the royal household. So they've recorded this in advance, and journalism gotcha's become a new thing. That is highly embarrassing. It does nothing for my former industry and your current. And it you understand why people get cynical about the media. Why you'd ever agree to do something like that in advance of it happening? Appalling.
I mean, newspapers particularly, Hutch, and we've all been part of this arrangement where, say you're in the lead up to the grand final and you work on a Sunday newspaper in that particular time, and there's a Saturday night preliminary final, but you want to have all the graphics ready for the Sunday morning first thing for the grand final matchup. You have to prepare copy for both scenarios. So I remember those scenarios, and that's just old-fashioned journalism, but I always got scared about hitting the send button on both of those articles.
So you'd write us.
One of them is wrong. One of them is wrong, and it's not that far-fetched for a quirk in the system to have that as the published article.
And then obviously
this is next level though. These are just lies.
So in your day, Carlton would be playing Richmond. You'd be on deadline. You'd have to write a story saying, well done, Carlton, great win. And then another story saying, fallout for Carlton's going to be big on the back of this loss. And you would send both versions of those stories, you're saying, to the editor of the Sunday Press so they had them on file in time for...
More for the graphic. Look, it would have been the period when Brisbane Lions were winning flags. So whoever was playing in that late Saturday night preliminary final, you had to have the graphic ready to go, obviously on both scenarios. So, but this is different. This hoax situation here is this is ego getting in the way of
It's hubris.
Journalism. And they wanting to be involved in something they knew was going to rate its socks off. That is the interview itself. But then for a program, the way it was pitched to them to be airing within an hour of it going to air was what ultimately had them falling over.
Well, it showed their prejudice. They had a prefix view of what they wanted to feel from that interview, and that is one of the big sins of journalism. It happens all the time. I don't think there were many people who sat down and watched that last night with a fully open mind. It became sport, which is why it had such a big lead-up and build-up, why there was misplaced leaks out of it. Like, one of the big commentary in the lead-up was that Megan had gone nuclear on Kate. It never happened. It was bad mail that was rewritten and accepted by journalists all over the world. The pre-leaks, it had a big kind of Super Bowl-style feel to it. It really did. It was a sage investment from Channel 10 to buy it. I thought they might have run it a little earlier, but I understand probably they got maximum impact ratings-wise out of it. But in reality, people couldn't help. People had a prejudice. People went in barracking for someone in that interview, and it's a bad indictment on how many people do you reckon sat down and went, well, you know, Megan and Harry aren't my cup of tea, but I'm going to give this a fair go and I'm going to make my own assessment and opinion.
No one.
Piers Morgan was at it 10 minutes in. You know, whatever your view was, you were able to use that interview to justify why you're already at that position.
What did you make, speaking of having a reaction to an interview, the fascinating Callum Toomey interview with Nathan Buckley? Nathan Buckley, for those not totally familiar with the scenario, had not spoken publicly since the Do Better report into the quote, the systemic racism of Collingwood Football Club. Nathan Buckley's been at Collingwood, Hutchie, for all but 1 year, since 1994, initially as a player, assistant coach, and then coach. There's been 1 year gap in that time frame for him. So he chose to speak with Callum Toomey on AFL.com.au. I think as far as a media exercise goes, and obviously I've got a bias here given the organisation with which he chose is the one I work for, but I think in an ability to, as a media product, present your side of a situation, I don't think it could have worked any better for what Collingwood and Nathan Buckley would have hoped to have got out of that situation, which is, again, the latest chapter of a very, very dark period of this football club.
Well, it's a step in the right direction. His ability to catch the mood of the room and articulate it is as good as anyone in football's. And just notwithstanding the failings of his club in the last several years, I thought on the... certainly on the racism, casual racism conversation that's going on around his club, he hit the right mark in terms of acknowledging that he'd walked past it a couple of times. And I think the other thing that I respected was he identified an occasion he could have done better, which was the 2017 press conference. When you go back and give specifics, it adds credence that you are taking it seriously. Often it's the journalist saying, on this day in 2017, you said this, Nathan, and him being forced to defend it, where he proactively tabled that in the conversation as a time he would have had his time again, he would have handled it differently. So I thought it was a step in the right direction, and it clearly showed a lot of the flaws of the other areas of the club. I thought on the Adam Treloar issue, he probably didn't... I know that he went on to qualify what he said, and that doesn't get run on the news grabs. But his conversation around how Adam Treloar and Phillips handled it differently probably wasn't needed. Again, he qualified it really well afterwards, but he's been around long enough to know that the grab, the 10-second grab on, was going to be interpreted as a criticism of Adam. And it was. It was interpreted that way, unfairly or otherwise, and probably didn't do much to mend those wounds, which... continued to fester. So I thought on 95% of it he was terrific, and on the Treloar stuff he probably fished in dangerous areas a little bit. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you with the Treloar thing, and I don't see any comparison at all with Tom Phillips. As good as Tom Phillips is as a player, it wasn't Adam Treloar. And Tom Phillips, as we know, Hutchie, by raising his name in the conversation, Nathan was saying that he embraced the need for a change. Well, as we all know, Tom Phillips had broached this particular topic the year before himself when he explored the market. So he was of a view and had an open mind to get out of Collingwood, whereas Adam Treloar, as we have since established, did not. So there was almost no comparison in that regard.
I know we've talked about it, but I don't think you can sell connection as your product and then argue that it's professional business when you make a blue on the salary cap and you have to throw one out the window. Like, I don't think those two go together. If you're truly connected, you're not making errors like that in the first instance. Anyway.
But Hutchie, I'm big on the rubbish that footy clubs bang on about being one in and all. You know, as we both know, Hutchie, once your career finishes at a footy club, and you may be a six-game player, you may be a four-time premiership player, but there is no guarantee that you are going to have a connection beyond the moment of that contract expiring. And I'm over the messaging of footy clubs that they keep banging on about. And the Treloar thing we discussed at the time on this very matter. Nathan Buckley is as good a media performer as there is right now. He to me is still a standout when it comes to media. So he has got the ability to talk about topics in certain ways that are media friendly. And you're referencing to him referring to the 2017 press conference was a perfect example of that. He was in a real bind, Hutchie. He was in a real bind with what he had said publicly about not hearing the nickname that the Collingwood players were subjecting Heretia Lumumba to, and also his treatment of it. And yet, the way he then referred to that, and I think this is very clever, and I took a bit out of this aspect of it, that by reacting to it and pushing back on the claims being made by Heretia, it is actually part of the systemic racism that the report conveyed. But unless he got out of it in such a clever way, to me he was backed into a corner given what he had said publicly about certain things.
Yeah, he handled it very, very well. Did you didn't watch Four Corners, or you watched it last night? And what did you make of the Canberra bubble story by Louise?
Yeah, I did watch that one. I was out family-wise and taped both programs, decided to watch the Four Corners one. Again, the second part of the bubble in Canberra to which Louise Milligan has put together just extraordinary old-school journalism. I want to talk about the Christian Porter press conference of last week, though, Hutchie, in a media sense, and it would be so much easier if we weren't talking about the subject of why he spoke. But we will, because that's what we do on this show. At that stage, the public was not aware he was the person being spoken about. Now, we live in the media bubble, and I'd be staggered if there was one person who's full-time in media who wasn't aware that Christian Porter was the subject of the conversation. But in terms of the wider public, again, how could you know what percentage to put on it? But I don't think too many people in the public would have known. So take me through his decision to have the press conference, and then we'll talk about the press conference itself, but confront the cameras and put his name into this scenario.
I'm interpreting that you think it was the wrong decision for him to face the media.
I still haven't got my head around that. I thought it was extraordinary when we knew the day before that he was going to do a press conference at 3 p.m. the next day. 3 p.m. came and went, and it was about maybe 3:15 that he fronted. And by then, we knew it was going to be him. And then he volunteered his name. He went quite specific at times on the allegations, but then when it suited him, said that he hadn't read certain parts of the allegations and was being told certain allegations. There was I still don't get my head around why he did it, and again, I don't believe too much of what he said.
When you say you don't believe too much of what he said, elaborate on that for me. You're casting doubt.
I think he's being very economical with the truth. I mean, to again, he got into detail, remembering a bowl of prawns, as he referred to it himself, and yet he can't remember having any correspondence with the person in question beyond this debating week that happened back in 1988. And he was very careful how he was happy to refer to some parts of it, but not other key elements of it. So you can have it both ways. You can't say that I haven't read the report or read the allegations, but I will refute these parts of it. You can't have it both ways. You're either all in on all of it, or you don't do it, is my take from a media exercise.
You think he's obviously read the report, right?
Yep.
And you think Scott Morrison's read the report?
I think Scott Morrison's read the report. And you know what? If he hasn't read the report, he should, because he is the Prime Minister of this country, and it was sent to him personally. And if he hasn't read it, we've got a problem. Because if he chose not to read it because of legal implications or ramifications for him, we'll get us another Prime Minister.
How did it make you feel? Has it forced you to...
Sick. Yeah. Sick. Yeah. For so many reasons. And again, this is not... I don't want to debate this on did he do it, because how would anyone know? And this is the problem with it. It's 33 years ago. But for it to play out the way it's played out, I'm sickened by it for what it's worth, given there was an awareness of this for so long before it became public in the way it did. And I'd like to get your take on it.
It's a confronting issue, because I don't feel equipped well enough to form an educated opinion on it. I've always felt innocent until proven guilty was a theme of life. But in recent years, I've learnt to my own lament that we need to take any claim and accept it as being serious and true. And those two thoughts compete with each other, and that's an evolution of all of us trying to understand. I'd like to see an inquest. I think we need one. Like, what is the downside to have an inquest into this issue and to take it? Allegations like this and voices like hers need to be heard and need to be respected. And to that tone, an inquest, it feels like the sense, common sense thing at the core level of respect to do. I don't proclaim to know what did or didn't happen, but I think it would be appalling to walk past the allegation and just get on with things because it didn't become a police claim, particularly in an area like Canberra, where there is clear evidence of behaviour not being up to public standard in Canberra on whatever level you decide to judge that. We need an inquest.
Again, I don't want you to do what you often do here when I start talking about Morrison and Turnbull and whatnot. Let's just debate this. But he thinks he's clever by pushing it off, referring to rule of law. And prior to that, he just thought he was smart. And he's a smug person when it comes to being out of his comfort zone, when it comes to the previous issue with the Brittany Higgins allegations. He felt it was a clever media strategy to talk about what his wife said to him and to treat this issue as though it's our daughters. I mean, what sort of leader actually addresses these issues like this? And I'll tell you what I also think on this, Hutchie. He's doing this to just prolong the debate around it in the hope that it eventually goes away. And he is just giving soundbite upon soundbite in the hope that it disappears. And that to me is the bigger problem, because these issues are now very much linked in terms of what Louise Milligan has put together now in two very, very detailed Four Corners reports about there being a massive problem there. And his attitude toward it, a bit like what Nathan Buckley has admitted to in hindsight, that his admission that he didn't do enough at the time, that to me that's where it's at the moment.
Well, by not wanting to be part of the solution, he's by extension part of the problem.
Yep.
Really.
And we know the way it works. He will hope to get re-elected. And either way, he's going to be out of the system in whatever amount of time it is. And the things that really need addressing are not going to be clearly dealt with under his watch.
These are very complicated issues, and society is having mature modern-day conversations for the first time, and that's a good thing. We can't walk past allegations like this. We can't.
No.
So just on Christian, so... Back to his decision to go public. I mean, he would have felt like everyone knew anyway, right? But in the bubble he lives in, everyone didn't know. But he lives in the bubble as 0.0001% of the public. So 99.5% of Australians didn't know he was accused last week. And when he decided to go public, he had to go fully public. He's absolutely entitled to defend himself and to deny his innocence.
100%. Absolutely is.
And he's entitled to a presumption of innocence. But I would think if you were the Attorney General of Australia and you welcome a thorough legal system, you would want an inquest. You would say, I'm opening up an inquest into this allegation about me so everyone can investigate and make their own view. And if you had nothing to fully hide, why wouldn't you expose yourself to that inquest? I feel like you're either in or you're out, right? You can't come forward and say, I didn't do it, but then, that bit's a bit hazy and that bit's a bit hazy. So that's I'm kind of with you on that. Or perhaps the other thing to do was to not put yourself forward and to legally and vigorously defend yourself privately until an inquest came or beyond. I'm not without human empathy, obviously. Like everyone, I was hard to watch him if he is indeed innocent, it was hard to watch him suffer in that regard.
Yep. Yep.
If he is guilty, that's a whole other story. But it was hard to, and I think the questions were fair. So a lot of debate around, Bill Shorten wasn't subject to this, and he had 10 months in 2004. Well, society's moved on in the last 7 years, and journalists were entitled in the room to ask those hard questions because he put himself there to make himself known. And the other thing it did is it invited coverage further. So by coming forward, last night's Four Corners could go into details about him that they couldn't previously. They mentioned many times that the reason they could now do this was because he had identified himself. It's a little bit like Ben Robert Smith from an, not to compare the issues, but from the journalistic tone of things. Ben Robert Smith is the only Soul Driver reference because in every story it says Ben Robert Smith has identified himself as one of the soldiers in question. There is a downside to making it public if you're not fully committed to the denial. It didn't feel fully committed. Maybe there's a legal reason for that, who knows.
And there's legal ramifications for whatever it is you then say the moment you choose to say it. Let's go back to Nathan Buckley, Hutchie. There was a report on Channel 7 encapsulating the Callum Toomey interview with Nathan Buckley from our man Tom Brown. And I just want you to just listen to this this last 10 seconds of this 90-second report on Nathan Buckley's interview by Tom Brown.
There's no doubt that everyone involved with the club was disappointed that it came out that way.
Buckley did the interview as part of a pre-season mandatory obligation with the AFL website. He'll have to face the media in the lead-up to round one, where he'll be asked more specifics. Tom Brown, 7 News.
First I've heard that. A drive-by for the fact that he didn't get the story to a mandatory AFL interview, but didn't ask specifics.
More specifics. Come on, Tom. What more specifics could you have asked? Did you listen and watch the whole thing? Come on, Tom.
Well, no, I think it's fair from Tom because I saw his tweet this morning about Megan and Harry. And so this is the type of specifics that Tom brings to the table and would have perhaps asked Nathan. Tom's tweet this morning, completely random observation on Megan and Harry's interview. This will really challenge people. They nailed the landscaping at their friend's house. As a keen renovator, the cobblestones, feature outdoor rug, and planting was outstanding.
I've told you, Hutchie, the mute button there, or the block button, whichever you want to go with, I think it might be the way to go. Tell me, Cooper Cronk, Hutchie, amazing rugby league player. Can you have a foot in two camps? You can't. And I say that because he's got an arrangement with the Melbourne Storm, with which he was a superstar. He's got an arrangement with the Roosters, which he also won a flag with, a premiership with. You cannot, in my mind, have a foot in both camps the way he's got a foot in both camps. If he wants to sell himself as a gun for hire and anyone can purchase his talents and expertise and advice, go for it. But I don't. This doesn't sit comfortable with me, Hutchie.
I think I
love everything about Cooper Cronk until this one.
That's unbelievably hypocritical from you. You've got a foot in the AFL.com camp, a foot in the Channel 9 camp, and a foot in the Sports Entertainment Network via the Sounding Board camp, and a foot in the Triple M camp. And depending on what time of the day it is where your content energy goes. That is one of the most hypocritical things I have heard you say in Series 6, Episode 6. So run me through this. Cooper's got 2 vested interests he provides services for. You've got 4. But you're saying in today's modern age,
sheep stations when it comes to an NRL premiership.
Oh, so we're talking about the significance of the money, are we?
Yeah, no, we're talking about the significance of the
you
the title,
more than Cooper.
The flag.
Your earnings
sport
are more than Cooper.
Far more important than the rubbish we do. But
right,
you do raise a good point.
You provide AFL.com, Channel 9, our business, and Triple M your services. And you're all leading the charge on Cooper not having 2 employers. I've heard
but
it all.
I'm regularly on record saying I've got as many conflicts as anyone's ever had, Hutchie. So I'm on record as saying
That's an embarrassing six love defeat of your argument on Cooper Cronk. You might as well just pack it up and go home with your rackets. It's all over.
You talk about football clubs before and this buy-in on connectivity and all-in, one-in, all-in situation.
Just on connectivity, by the way.
This is the same rubbish that Nathan Buckley's trotting out about Adam Treloar and having him being connected in 2020, but not at the end of 2020 when he was to move him on. This is the same thing. Clubs value their intel and their IP in such a way, Hutchie, that you can't have someone walking in and out of certain clubs whenever he wants to.
Thank you, linesman. Thank you, ball boys. You just don't have any credibility in this space. By the way, when did connectivity become the word of 2021 where everyone rips the the con in it. Like, it used to be connectivity. Now it's connectivity. Everyone's decided that they've got a different way of phrasing the word. But that's another story for another day. I thought the Phil Rothfield exchange on NRL last night with Cooper was good. I thought both gave as good as they got. It was nice to see some old school journalism questioning it from Buzz. And it was nice to see Cooper articulate it the way that he did in response. And I mean, the services industry, there's blurred lines everywhere, let's be honest. It's fascinating. Hey, speaking of media, by the way, Channel 7 was a little bit of taking out the trash from 7 about this. They let slip last night while the two big TV shows were on that their footy coverage is pretty much settled. So looks like Brian Taylor leading the coverage Friday and Sunday from a calling perspective. Brayshaw, we're told, is a lock for Friday night, so it's a BT and Brayshaw combo. Hamish is the front man. Good ins on the team of Selwood and Nick Nat, but looks like BT and JB have got the gig, which is full circle from their 9 days. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it would be. And obviously a continuation of the Triple M marriage.
Yeah, the Triple M Saturday coverage. So will they call Saturdays together still on Triple M? Oh, James doesn't really go much anymore, but when available, once every 3 or 4 months, he'll be there. And that's well done to James, by the way. That's a fantastic. He deserves that Friday nights, in all seriousness. Great gig and thoroughly deserved by he and Brian. Just 8 days out from the season.
Yep. Why was it taking out the trash?
Well, an event like that with two big names, you'd announce it on a day where you can get some media oxygen, would you? Not on the night when there's two massive stories taking everyone's energy.
So are they trying to hide this or slide this one through, are they? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think they're trying to be respectful to Bruce and the exit to not, you know, put too much over exposure into the... Well, look at us, we've now replaced him, and how good's this? You'll see the cheesy photos next week, I'm sure, with them, one of them carrying the footy with the Channel 7 logo on it and all that original stuff that the PR teams do. So I look forward to that. We'll have an all-points bulletin out on the cheesy photo of JB and BT and how much they are quote-unquote looking forward to working together. That'll be one to keep an eye out for the sounding board for tenor.
When we get those photos, we can revisit the ones you did for the footy show, Hutchie, those years ago too.
Yeah, guilty as charged on that front. I am, no question.
Hutchie, that's it for another episode of the sounding board for Drinkwise. You won't miss a moment if you drink wise.
And if you want to have four employers and criticise someone that has two, you won't miss a moment if you listen to Damo for Drinkwise.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Board podcast with Hutchie and Damo. Tune in for questions tomorrow, and to send a question to the boys, email thesoundingboard@sen.com.au, follow the show on Twitter @soundingboardep, and like the Facebook page. It's all thanks to Drinkwise. If you're choosing to have a drink, choose to Drinkwise.